Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we are here at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And that, of course, assuming that today is Saturday, September 26, 2015. And I finally figured out what day it is, which means that tomorrow's going to come and I'm going to be messed up and not know what day it is. So, let's see. What you have something to say?
Yeah, I wanted to finish off some of the news snippets, the good news snippets that I was covering in the last hour. Did you have some things that you wanted to say first?
Oh, yeah, I've got things I want to say, but okay. you can finish off the good news, both subjects.
Both of these are things, well, the first piece that I mentioned about fusion. Don't expect to see that be the newest method of power for a while. And the other two stories that I'm going to talk about are also in the same category. These are very early stages in something that is a movement. There's a new ion drive that's just been invented by a University of Sydney doctoral candidate, and it is 50% more efficient than NASA's version. And I can hear the people starting to drool already. Why is an ion drive important? Well, we talk about precious metals quite a lot when we talk about the economy. People talk about buy gold, sell gold, all of that. We talk about we on this program have talked in the past about how it is a great investment if you're in electronics. It's a great investment if you are in jewelry. It's not a great investment any other term. You don't buy something because it's rare, because if there's more of it around, it becomes worth less. And an ion drive that is 50% more efficient than NASA's version, that was created by one guy in a lab, is not as efficient as it's going to get. And if you can get 50% efficiency boosts, you can get a lot more of that. There's more efficiency there. Why is that important? Because they are very, very cheap engines that you can put on asteroids. And over a decade, direct huge amounts of precious metal into the orbits around Earth to be mined. This is something that means long-term, if you're thinking that in 20 years holding gold will be a great idea, I wouldn't bet on it, because yeah, SpaceX is already up into orbit, and if SpaceX is up in orbit, then they can send out ion drives to attach with drones to asteroids to bring them into the right orbit.
There have been two asteroids pass relatively close to Earth recently that are very carefully tracked, by the way.
Right.
One of which was almost pure platinum. And
$11 trillion worth of platinum. Of course, if you could sell it all, platinum would not be, it wouldn't be worth $11 trillion. It would have lowered the price drastically.
There was another one which had a very high percentage of gold in it.
Right.
So, the long-term outlook for precious metals is somewhat low. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, there was a time when Spain sent a lot of ships out because the precious metal prices were high, and so they sent a lot of ships out to a new country to mine it, and it was a massive amount of money to put together those expeditions. But the expeditions were funded by the gold on the other end, so more expeditions went, and don't be surprised if that happens again, only instead of ships across water, it's ships across space.
And gold dropped by 90% and never recovered.
Right.
Hey, there's a completely different subject that I want to talk about.
Okay.
And it's not good news if you have a 401k or 403b or other retirement plan. You need to look very carefully at the funds in your 401k. And I'm going to use 401k as a generic term to mean all retirement plans that contain mutual funds. Apparently, about 15% now, or 16%, of the fund values that are in 401ks are not mutual funds. Now, this is, you may say, so big deal. As a matter of fact, what they're called is collective trust funds. Fidelity is pumping out a lot of them right now. And that sounds like some esoteric who cares. You know, you've got the such and such and such fund from Fidelity, and whether it's a mutual fund or a collective trust fund, what's the difference? Well, the difference is night and day. The collective trust funds are not transparent. In other words, you don't know for sure what's in there. And they are basically run by whatever company, whatever way they want to run them. And they are not protected under the law against the liabilities of the issuing company. For example, if Fidelity, which is a privately held company, and I'm not suggesting that there's anything financially wrong with the Fidelity Corporation, but I will say that if they have a mutual fund that's a Fidelity mutual fund, and they have a collective trust fund that's a Fidelity collective trust fund in a 401k, and Fidelity were suddenly to do a Volkswagen or do a Lehman Brothers or any of these other companies that just suddenly, unexpectedly, something comes up and they're gone.
Enron, WorldCom.
If the collective trust fund, your interest in the collective trust fund would be an unsecured liability against Fidelity, which at this point probably would be bankrupt.
No, we're not trashing Fidelity here.
I'm not trying to say that.
In fact, we have a great deal of admiration for the company as a whole.
But what I want to say is if you have a mutual fund that's issued by Fidelity, which is a different thing, and Fidelity goes under, the mutual fund is protected. Your assets in the mutual fund are protected by the Investment Company Act of 1940 from the creditors of Fidelity. You still own the shares. Matter of fact, you owned the shares the whole time. Whereas if it's a unit trust of some kind, a collective trust fund, you don't own the units in the shares. You have basically a liability. Fidelity has a liability to pay you if they're solvent. So if you have 401k, 403b, something that has mutual funds or something that you think are funds in them, look carefully to ensure that what you're investing in is in fact a mutual fund registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940. And that means, yes, I know this is terrible. You have to go online and get the prospectus. Now, by the way, if you go online and you discover there is no prospectus, there's maybe an offering circular or a summary or something else, and you can't find a prospectus for the thing you're investing in your retirement plan, there's a pretty fair chance it's not protected under the Investment Company Act of 40, and it is not a mutual fund. And some company that's issued it basically just owes you that money, but the security of that money is only as good as the company that issued it. And in many cases, I've seen a lot of these where the company is I don't recognize the company that I see it that has all the funds in there, and it is a little I shouldn't say a fly by night, but it's some company that's issuing a bunch of stuff and it goes into a 401k, and they have cut a deal with your employer where it's less expensive to the employer to have that 401k as opposed to one from, for example, Vanguard, which is still pretty cheap. But Vanguard has very, very low expenses in its funds, and as a result, the employer has to pay a little more to have the 401k set up. If you go in there and you discover that what you have in there doesn't have a prospectus, or if the prospectus doesn't say that it's registered under the Act of 40, under the Investment Company Act of 1940, move into another investment in your 401k. And if your 401k doesn't have any mutual funds in it, it only has stuff that's not mutual funds, you really need to pay very close attention to this and maybe talk to your employer about it, because you are at risk there to lose literally all the money that's in there. And I'm not trying to be unduly alarmist, but 10 years ago, these things didn't exist. And if you recall, it's been almost, it's working on 10 years, it's 2008, We're now in 2015. We're basically during the last crisis. These collective investment trusts, these collective trust funds, didn't exist. And now they do. They haven't been tested in a downturn in the market, and they certainly haven't been tested in a major downturn in the market. And they're a lot like ETFs. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but for instance, Lehman Brothers did in fact have about a half dozen ETFs they had issued. And if you, that's exchange traded funds. And if you had been an investor in one of those exchange traded funds, when Lehman Brothers failed, you would be an unsecured creditor of Lehman Brothers, and in some cases, you would still be waiting to see if you got, how much money you got back on your funds that you had that were issued by Lehman Brothers. The Investment Company Act of 40 is a crucial, crucial thing. A mutual fund, by definition, is covered by that. ETFs sometimes are, but commonly are not. And in the case of these collective trust funds, they are not covered at all. There's no prospectus, and there's very, very little transparency.
They're actually not regulated by the SEC. They're regulated by the Labor Department.
And the Labor Department doesn't have any police.
Yeah. The Labor Department leans on the IRS as their police force. And when it comes to retirement plans, sometimes they use the SEC, but in cases like this, they wouldn't. It would have to be an IRS officer, which means that there is less oversight. It's strange because I think a lot of our listeners agree with us in the concept of having a smaller government, that smaller government is good. It's more efficient. It's better for business. There are certain areas that smaller government is not good. Smaller government is not good at regulating quality of food or quality of safety of a product that's being sold. So certain areas have to be regulated, and if you can get a group together to do it on its own, that's fine. But when the government gets involved, they can point at the regulation and say, okay, this is good. When we're looking at a regulatory authority that really doesn't have a police force. Let me make an analogy here. It's kind of like going to a butcher shop in a third world country. The reason why our meat in the grocery store is at the standard that it is because of a regulatory authority. People get in trouble. They can go to jail for selling tainted meat. Well, I don't think that that's a bad idea. Well, that means that you have to have inspectors. The Labor Department doesn't have inspectors, not in the same number as are required for really policing the 401ks. They're looking at the employers and saying, please operate in your own best interest and in the interests of your employees. They're actually saying, operate in the best interest of your employees. Well, if the company, how many people think that there may be a little bit of danger in the idea of all companies should operate in the best interest of their employees? We think there might be a little conflict there somewhere, just for you to know about. So when we're talking about this, there's a level of regulation that's being skipped. Usually a CIT, and that CIT, Collective Investment Trust, that's what he's been talking
right.
about, are designed to be identical to a mutual fund. They may even have the same manager.
But interesting point. If you have a CIT, and Fidelity, for example, has come out with a series of CITs that have the same name as some of the mutual funds, you'll be able to tell fairly quickly they will not have a ticker symbol.
Right.
You can't look them up in the paper. You can't go to Morningstar and look them up because they don't report.
Yeah. So a CIT has the same manager. The manager's responsibility is, in essence, the same, but the corporate responsibility is different. The corporate responsibility is it's easier to get away with things. Now, they're still held to a high standard because they're in a retirement plan. The Labor Department says this is the standard at which you must operate. But then they're not policed. And
yeah, it's like Volkswagen.
Right. And even though that money is held in trust, it's only held in trust by the people holding it. They're required to have some bonds on their good activity, but the bond is not enough to cover all the assets. So Volkswagen made a mistake but it did it intentionally.
And it's entirely possible that a company, including Fidelity, and I'm not saying Fidelity's doing it, any corporation is in the business of making a profit, not in the business of making you happy. They make you happy if it's profitable. Yeah,
let me reiterate that. Let me say it double with exclamation points. We not only are not suggesting that Fidelity is doing that, we believe that Fidelity would not do that intentionally, would not break the laws intentionally. We're using them as an example because they do a lot of CITs, and we've used Vanguard as an example in the past for some of their funds and some of the issues that we have with Vanguard over exchange-traded funds and so on. So we're using Fidelity because they're kind of the leaders in the CIT world and the collective investment trust world. My issue with it is relatively easy. It's a simple piece that could be fixed at any point. Why don't they just make it a mutual fund?
Well,
it only costs a very small amount of money to make the mutual fund.
But they have to file it with the SEC.
Correct.
They have to issue prospectuses.
Yep.
They have to provide the prospectuses on demand.
I think all of those things are good things.
And so what happens is any corporation is in the business of making profits for itself. And that's their driving goal, just like at Volkswagen. I read an interesting article at Volkswagen. What happened was the environmental rules, both in Europe and in the United States, went up for diesel. In other words, they said you can't just be pouring smoke into the air and nitrogen oxides into the air, because they then morph into other things that cause people to have lung disease, and there's a lot of them appearing in the air. But this happened just as the financial crisis was hitting, and Volkswagen had a new CEO,
right?
And his goal was to make Volkswagen the biggest producer, to pass Toyota as the biggest automobile producer on the planet. And he wanted to have low cost, high performance, and then they had the financial crisis, and he looks around and says, we can either spend a lot of money
on research and development,
like General Motors did, like Ford did, and everybody else on
Toyota did.
Well, actually, they have this system, and I have a diesel truck, so I can tell you that it does work. Where you pour this stuff into a tank, it costs money, and it's a pain to do. But you got to pour this stuff into a tank in the engine compartment, and it mixes it with the exhaust from the diesel coming out somewhere in there, so that it burns up the nitrogen oxide and brings it down to within normal limitations. But that increases the cost of the vehicle, and it means there's one other thing you have to add to the vehicle, and so that's a pain. So they decided to cheat instead. And the point is that
Volkswagen did.
Volkswagen decided to cheat to increase their profitability. I'm not saying that any given company at any given moment will cheat, but it's one of those things that you have
some
to
company
be
will.
Aware of. Particularly with financial companies, where you can't measure, you don't hold in your hand what it is you're purchasing. And when financial companies come out and with a new product, and one of the things that comes out that's in the Wall Street Journal article about this is the companies, including Fidelity, who have produced these things, go out of their way to make them look like mutual funds.
Yeah.
So that the typical 401k participant doesn't know that they're not a mutual fund.
Naming them the same name as the mutual fund that they're supposed to track. And so it may have the same manager. It may have the same name. It won't have a ticker.
It won't have a ticker symbol. And that's the key that should alert you that you're not dealing with a mutual fund. It's not filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. It is strictly being run internally at the company. And that's why the Investment Company Act of 40 was passed, is because people were running funds like this and they blew up during the Great Depression. What happened was, in some cases, they were leveraged. In some cases, they had investments in there other than what they were supposed to have. In some cases, well, there's an awful lot of activity went on that when the fund blew up was the first time anybody knew that they really weren't invested in what they thought they were invested in.
Yeah, there's a here's an example of a financial company recently that's gone through this sort of scenario. PIMCO. PIMCO had a stellar reputation, absolutely spotless, shining reputation of being excellent for bond purchases and ethical, and Bill Gross made a name by going out and buying bonds and being very good at the right bonds to buy. They hired as a manager the guy that had managed the Yale Endowment Fund. And the Yale Endowment Fund, all the way up through the mid-2000s, had done spectacularly well. Well, it turns out part of the reason why it had done well is because the manager had purchased these huge, and by huge I mean absolutely ginormous, tracts of forest land. Huge tracts of forest land. And put them on the books as an investment for the endowment fund. Now, looking ahead, that forestry was supposed to be used for paper. So they had a...
And wood.
They had a projected value for lumber and paper that as the time got closer for harvest, the value of the portfolio would grow by that amount. So it's not affected by the market at all. It's not publicly traded. You just have this mathematical calculation that says this is what it's worth based on what lumber and paper are going to be.
But it was all dependent upon the housing boom, though.
Right. The housing boom's going on. Lumber and paper are being sold at great quantities. This is great. Until the market dipped. And the market dipped right after the manager of the Yale Endowment Fund had moved over to PIMCO. The market dipped.
Muhammad El Orion.
Yes.
Who's still quite famous as being a heroic
manager. Right. So Yale then says, well, we're going to need to dip into the endowment so that we can pay for things while the other portion of the market is down. So they went to look and see what they could sell, and they realized that nobody wants to buy absolutely huge, ginormous tracts of forest land.
Particularly in the middle of a housing collapse where nobody's buying lumber.
Right. Particularly at a time when there are beetles ravaging the pine forests.
Right.
So they realized that the value of their portfolio was not the value of their portfolio.
and not only was it not the value
of their portfolio, nobody could tell them what the value actually was. Because when you get an appraisal done on your house, the appraiser looks around at comparables. They say other houses that have sold in the recent past that are about this size and in this neighborhood. Okay, nobody's purchased 11 million acres of forest land in the past few years. It's really hard to get it comparable. And that was just one of the smaller tracts that we're talking about.
And the same thing easily could occur without any ill intent. For example, a lot of the CITs, which is what these collective investment trusts that are in mutual, that are in 401ks are, track indexes. Well, no index tracking fund actually owns all of the stocks in the index. They buy derivatives and do interesting and unusual things to match the price of the index.
Right.
And if you, as long as it's a mutual fund, every quarter they have to publish exactly what they own to do that. And so analysts at Morningstar and other places can look at it and say, is this reasonable? In a CIT.
Well, hold on just a second.
What?
Just as a quick why. Why is it they don't own all of the stocks in the index? People have asked me that. Well, why wouldn't they just do that? Because an index like the S&P 500, when it's published, it doesn't have trading costs. It doesn't have, if one company becomes smaller than another, and so they have to swap out what's in the index. They just take one company out and put in the other company. The new, bigger company goes in and replaces. So if there's 500 companies in there, the 500 biggest is the smallest in the index, and it gets swapped out. Okay.
Anyway.
It doesn't cost anything to do that. So if you're going to own all those stocks, you would have to sell, which costs money, and buy, which costs money.
And the little stocks in there don't make that much difference in the value of the index, so they basically buy a derivative of all those little stocks.
Right.
Now, in a CIT, because they don't have to publish what they have, And no outside analysts are going to look at it and see what they have. They can get really creative in the derivatives they buy to track the index, and they can lower the costs of buying those by buying big chunks of derivatives to track the index rather than actually owning the majority of the stocks in the index. The problem, of course, with that is that owning, as soon as you get literally hundreds of billions of dollars buying these derivatives, it used to be just a few million buying.
Right.
Those derivatives, nobody knows how they're going to behave in the future. And I'm simply saying that if you have a 401k...
Wait, you're not simply saying. Well, no, this, you're saying.
I'm simply saying if you have a 401k and you have investments in there and they don't have ticker symbols, you are taking a risk that is being very carefully hidden by just about everybody involved. It's legal. They do have an annual outside accountant firm come in and look at it to make sure that they in fact own all the things they say they own, although they don't tell you what they own and they don't tell your employer what they own. And that the books balance, but that's not to say that they're not taking some really wild risk that may have worked in the past but may not work at some point in the future. So we've gone on and on about this, simply to say that CITs are inherently dangerous. They're new, they're derivatives, and they are not transparent, and they're not protected under the law. That should tell you about all you need to know about them.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough of that. We are listening to Personal Wealth Coach, and we do have some commercials to play to keep Town Square Media nice and profitable and KTEM on the air. You can call us on the other side of these commercials, presuming today is September 26, 2015, at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the... No, you're... One of us got that one wrong.
No, I don't know. We don't know how to say our names very well.
So here, we're back with the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake. Dump.
I messed that one up. You did.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do that again. We're back with the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I should have intentionally just messed it up and see how long we could have continued messing up.
We could probably go on to the end of the hour just messing up our. You know, anyway. Yeah.
Yes. I have two headlines to read, one after another. I'm not going to read the story. Just going to read the two headlines. They are in the same webpage. It's finance.yahoo.com, which kind of conglomerates some other places. But they're headlines that actually border each other at the moment. So the first headline, Boehner resignation cuts U.S. government shutdown risk. Okay.
Got it. All right.
Second headline. Right next to the first. Boehner resignation increases the prospects for government shutdown.
Well, wait a minute. Here's the issue. The first one indicated that the risk of the government not shutting down.
No, the risk of government shutdown is cut.
But it increased the prospects.
Well, Boehner resignation cuts U.S. government shutdown risk. Boehner resignation increases the prospects for government shutdown. What that means, folks, is that the financial media is clueless.
Actually, Boehner's resignation increases the uncertainty.
Yes, exactly. And that's something you could say with a great deal of surety, is that we're not sure. I'm very confident to say that I'm not confident at all.
Since we're on the subject of Speaker Boehner's resignation, I would say that Speaker Boehner's resignation probably increases the probability that Hillary Clinton will be our next president.
That is a likelihood, because what that means is there will be a power struggle in the European Republican leadership.
It's called a knife fight.
There is a power struggle in the European leadership at the same moment.
Yeah, there will be blood spilled on the floor of the House in some form or fashion, metaphorically.
Hopefully allegorically only.
But the point is that, I know a lot of conservatives don't like Speaker Boehner, and they don't like him because he does whatever is necessary to make things work and keep them working and show
he's good at making
the House.
Sausage.
He's good at making the House of Representatives work and function and under the Republicans. If the conservatives, there are 29 conservatives in the conservative caucus who consistently have been against him, are successful in putting somebody in there that listens to them more successfully, then the next year or so will be a series of confrontations, threatened shutdowns, and really scary.
And that's been shown again and again and again to be bad in the popularity race of elections.
And that will... very high probability that that will mean that the Democratic nominee gets elected president, which would mean that...
I don't think that a huge number of the House of Representatives listens to our program. If they did, they would either turn it off or be functioning differently.
Or pass a bill to ban it,
right.
More likely.
The idea that they are this short-sighted, you know, they are. They are.
The 29 members of the Conservative Caucus, one of whom is John Carter, he's the secretary, have driving their activities idealism. And they have
they're sticking
very
to their principles.
Principles and very strong ideals. Unfortunately, the rest of the country does not necessarily. And the 29 members, by the way, when you consider there's like 435 or 38, 438. How many members are there in the House? Is it 338 or 430? Anyway, consider that only 29 of them are in the conservative caucus, what that really boils down to is if you peel that 29 out of the Republican Party, the Republican Party no longer has enough votes to pass a bill if the Democrats object to it. So that particular 29 representatives, which is any way that you approach it, it is less than 10% of the House of Representatives and represents districts that have been, in most cases, carved out to support having a very conservative member of the House. That particular 10% of the electorate and that particular 10% of the House of Representatives has a lot of power.
435.
There's 435 and then there's 29, so that's not... even 10%. Okay, about 7%. So
there's also some non-voting delegates. There's five of those.
Yeah, well, I don't count
one
those.
From D.C., the Virgin Isles, Guam, American right. Samoa, the Commonwealth of Northern
that's,
Mariana
that's
Islands. Yes.
TMI.
They get to sit in the House and do nothing.
And get paid for it.
Right. Well, they do actually get to talk to people.
That's good. So, freedom of speech.
Yes.
Anyway, the point is that this particular 29 are not people whose views are shared by the majority of Americans. I can say that.
It's true.
And just like there is probably an equivalent group over the Democrats, I just don't know who they are and I don't know what caucus it is. Even though I've looked, I can't find it.
There are 247 Republicans.
Okay. So roughly... a little over 10% of the Republicans, if you got 29,
mm-hmm.
are in the conservative caucus. They have a tremendous amount of power, though.
Yeah.
And so because their failure to support the Republicans by simply stepping out of the vote, the Democrats win. So they have a tremendous amount of power to affect what goes on the Republican side. And it's good to have people like that. However, if they exercise that control to elect a Speaker of the House to support their positions, they will almost certainly alienate the vast majority of Americans. And once they start alienating the vast majority of Americans, when a national election comes along, that vast majority of Americans will probably express themselves in a manner unfavorable to that party.
Yeah, it
doesn't make any difference whether Democrats or Republicans doing this, by the way.
I have a lot of fun laughing at European politics, looking at the parliaments of the different places and how they have eight different political parties and they have to get in a big scrum to see who has the majority, because nobody actually has the majority. They have to get with a bunch of other parties to have a coalition, and the coalition is the leading whatever. We have the same thing. We just don't call it that. We have 29 members that are really not part.
Yeah, they're really
like
a different party.
In Europe, they would be considered a small extreme party. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a bunch of centrist Democrats and a bunch of centrist Republicans. And by a bunch, it's not as much as they used to be. As you said,
right.
Polarity tends to make it so that districts line up with the same membership every time.
Right.
We don't have a popular representation of the percentage of Republicans or Democrats. There's been some gerrymandering. You've got districts that are going to always vote Republican because that's the way they're designed. There's districts that will always vote Democrat because that's the way they're designed.
Right.
Which is why we have more extremism in the House than we do in other places. If you look at the Senate, it's much more in line with the rest of the view of the country because you only have two per state. And each Senate race, the whole state votes in. So that makes the Senate a better representation of the way people feel in the country. And that's the way it was designed. However, if we get a minority of the majority party that stops government repeatedly, it makes the whole party look horrible.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the whole party suffer, so that even if you get somebody that is more likely to win in an election, a more centrist person, that person is going to have their popularity drop because the rest of the party's not on board.
There's several bills coming up after Speaker Boehner's departure. Now, he's probably going to get a bill pushed through with the Democrats and the Republicans, both the votes from both sides, to fund the government before the end of this month. I mean, we don't have a bill right now to fund the government after the end of this month.
It's kind of nice to have the lights stay on in the Pentagon.
And we could get a government shutdown at the end of this month. I doubt it. However, sometime towards the end of October, beginning of December, we get the debt ceiling issue again.
Yeah.
And the highway, right now we don't have a bill to fund highway construction in the United States, which, by the way, in the case of Central Texas here, which means that if we don't get a bill, then the construction grinds to a halt. And it's just left
just
the way
like
it is.
Left in middle of construction forever.
There's a series of these bills coming up over the next several months. And it will be interesting to see. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is not because we want to take political positions, and I make a point of not taking political positions. The reason I'm bringing this up is any of these events, government shutdowns, for instance, in 2011 and in 2013, produced recessions or near recessions. Corrections or near corrections in the stock market. They can produce some really bad movements in the stock market. If, for example, the leadership in Congress becomes further polarized, and we don't reinstate the Export-Import Bank, which has been defunded as of July by Congress, not by an act, but by the failure to act, which was, again, blocked by the conservative caucus.
GE just came out with a report this week saying that they were going to be building a facility, a nuclear facility in India, using pretty advanced technology, but in the process solidifying some of our alliance with India in the area against Islamic extremism, for one thing.
Right.
It was going to be a top-of-the-line nuclear facility, and they're not going to do it because one of the functions of the Import-Export Bank
is to finance things like that.
Well, not just the finance, but also to give a diplomatic exclusion to some of the laws.
Mm-hmm.
After Union Carbide's disaster in India, where the cyanide tank exploded and killed a lot of people, India changed its corporate law structure to leave the executive board fully criminally liable for any disasters that took place. so that if GE invests in putting in a nuclear facility there, because they manufacture it and in 20 years it blows up, the CEO of GE has to go to prison in India. If they go through the import-export bank, there's a diplomatic separation that says that the laws of the corporate America cover corporate action through the bank into India.
Mm. Well,
there's a liability
that
issue.
In both GE and, it was interesting you mentioned GE, GE's turbine manufacturer, they're going to build a new plant, and they were going to build it, and they got a whole series of things going, and they're going to, they said they will build their plant outside the United States where they can get the equivalent of the Import-Export Bank funding. And Boeing has already said they're going to move production outside the United States if it doesn't come back. Yeah. And Microsoft has said the same thing.
Oreo just moved a big factory outside into Mexico. It's the same concept. It's if you continue to make business hard, if trying to close all the loopholes in the corporate tax code when we have the highest tax brackets in the world for corporations, period. And that is verifiable. Look it up. We are the highest tax rates in the world on the corporate level. No wonder people in corporations, they're paying taxes in the country that they make the money, and then they've got to come back and pay more taxes in the United States if they bring the money back. Well, why would they do that?
Well,
you wouldn't want to do that.
So these are all issues that do have an effect, and you, by the way, have an effect on them, listener, because you can write John Carter and tell him that you don't like these things if you keep up with them. I mean, on the other hand, you may say, hey, get rid of the Export-Import Bank. Well, if you do, then you're going to be moving manufacturing jobs outside the United States.
Right. That's just going to happen.
You might say, well, you know, shut down the government when the...
let me say one other thing.
Over some issue.
The government doesn't fund the Import-Export Bank. It funds itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's one of the big things people say, well, we shouldn't be spending money on taxpayer money on. It's only taxpayer money in that the taxpayers own it, because the Import-Export Bank is a for-profit entity. It uses the profits later to fund other things so that it's not a budgetary hit. It doesn't hurt Congress's ability to do other things, but it needs Congress's mandate to exist, and they have withdrawn it. That's insane. Politics.
Speaking of insane, we have some more commercials to play. So I've still got some things I want to talk about with regard to where the market is going in all likelihood.
We should give our phone numbers one more time.
Right. 773-1400 in East Bell County or
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
And we'll be back after these words from Town Square and KTEM. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure.
Not much time left.
Nope, not much time left. We just have about 3 or 4 minutes left. I wanted to hit a couple of things. BlackRock came out with a forecast for the market for the next 2 years. They said average annual returns of 5% are going to be normal. But that the market will be higher at the end of this year than it is, then again higher at the end of next year, which is a very conservative way to approach the whole thing. The Chinese scare of the collapse of the China economy or something is a non-starter, apparently. Some people who have been in China have now come back out and reported, and they say, no, it's a black box, and there's not much we can tell about it, but I can tell you that it ain't that bad over there. The growth rate may be somewhat slower than has been reported in the past, but China is transitioning to a consumer economy, and so is India. And that's going to be bumpy, and that's going to slow things down a little bit. They're going from an export economy to a consumer economy. And when you look at the hundreds of millions of people in China who are becoming consumers who want to buy things, many of them made in the United States, in the long term, that is a very, very good thing. And the fact that they're making the transition may make it a little bumpy, But the fact is also that they are moving towards a, and as they move to a more consumer-oriented model, and their job is to keep consumers happy, they are far less likely to go to war somewhere, because that doesn't make consumers particularly happy. Russia, on the other hand, doesn't care whether their consumers are happy or not. So that's two issues. We've got reports out of China that their economy is not in bad shape. Their markets are meaningless because they're so tiny. So that's one of those things that you might want to bear in mind. The other thing to bear in mind about China, the opposite end of that thing, is people are afraid that China's going to take over everything. And the people are saying Chinese economy is bigger than the U.S. economy. Not so. Not so. Not so. If you take the official numbers, which are fictitious, you can make an argument that they're going to take over the world. If you take the real numbers, the numbers that economists look at about the things that can actually be measured, China's economy is A, smaller than ours, and B, growing at about the same speed as ours, which should say that there's no real danger of them running over us. We're moving along at about the same speed. So those are two aspects about China, I think, that are very, very, very important. You got something you want to finish off? Because I've got another thing if you don't.
We're about out of time. Yep.
We don't have time for anything. Okay, we'll talk about that next week, but I think I know who's going to be the next president. But go ahead.
All right. If you'd like to contact us off the air, you are welcome to do so. We have voicemail waiting on the weekends locally at
947-1111 in East Bell County, 947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletters. You can listen to our more innately on our podcasts. You can see our made-for-radio faces and the beautiful people that we work with.
TEM, AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.